The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
Good morning and welcome to Pebble in Your Shoe Tuesday. I have some good time available today for you to just chime in with your concerns. And maybe it's some good news that you've heard too. Always happy to get some good news. Join in at 770-563-3770-KMED. Now, there was some good news over the weekend. Didn't get a chance to mention this yesterday in the midst of all of the tragedy of what's going on back east and in North Carolina. And had a lost hiker ended up being saved and rescued on Mount McLaughlin over the weekend. That happened on Saturday. And it was a 40-year-old man from Central Point who had gone up there. And it was a solo climb on Mount McLaughlin. Probably not ever usually the best idea. Usually better to have at least a partner there with you. But he got lost after he got to the summit. So he got all the way up there, 9,500 feet. But then everything took a lot longer. The days are getting shorter, as you know. Daylight faded. He found himself in unfamiliar territory and no food and water, or dwindling food and water. And his phone battery was dying, too. And he texted his girlfriend, who then ended up getting in touch with the 911 center here in Jackson County. And so they sent out search and rescue, and they pinged his phone, and they found him about 9:30 at night, dehydrated and very tired. And by the way, I guess it's, even though it was relatively warm days, up there it was like 29 degrees. So, you know, we're already into pretty dangerous times. But he ended up getting rescued, and it was a happy ending there. And I'm glad to see something like that. But boy, you know, we do see every now and then some teachable moments like this, because he didn't have a lot of spare water, apparently. Not a lot of food either. Not that you wanted to, you know, take tons and tons of food for a day hike. Water's probably more important than anything else. But a dwindling cell phone battery, no alternative ways of hiking. And I'm trying to think of, I haven't gone hiking for a number of years. Got a left knee, it's starting to bug me a little more than it used to. So I treated a little more gingerly than I once did. But I never relied on, and this is just me, maybe you have different ways of dealing with this, but when I've gone hiking, I don't take just a cell phone, because a cell phone can be hit or miss. In fact, all radio communications up there can be hit or miss depending on the terrain and where you happen to be. Of course, a satellite phone, if you can afford that, great, good for you, but that's a little out of my budget, probably out of yours too, or most people. But they also have those hiker beacon type things that you can buy in the stores, and $100-$200, you know, those sort of things. And that might not be such a bad idea if you're going to be going out there and hiking in the high country by yourself. Better not to be by yourself. But I always took ham radio with me too, and I always took a 2-meter. You know, 144 megahertz, just lots of mountaintop repeaters around here in Southern Oregon. GMRS wouldn't be a bad idea to take one of those things, too. Yeah, you know, take an alternate to the cell phone. The cell phone, in this particular case, helped him, but gosh, he was dying on battery, losing battery power. It's like, boy, it's a hell of a reason to not make it back. Fortunately, he did. They were able to ping him in time. But that's really not something that you have to put up with these days. Those portable little power packs that you can get for $20-$30, you know, you stick it in the backpack and it has a cell phone charger too, and you could use it to charge all sorts of different things. It would just be a good idea. It's worth the a few ounces of weight, you know, to go in the background and to go into the backpack. Always make sure there's a way. Always make sure there's a way. Always have some extra water. A way to filter water, too, although I don't know if there would have been a lot of water up there at the summit available even to filter. But, you know, if it rained, you never know, right? You know, that kind of thing. But maybe we talk about that this morning, sort of some teachable moments. I'm just glad it worked out for this 40-year-old Central Point man. It really could have gone really sideways very quickly, and it didn't. So there's some good news on the Pebble in Our Shoe Tuesday. Or Pebble in Our Hiking Boot Tuesday, right? That kind of thing. Any suggestions from you, too, 770-5633. Now, if you're like me, and I know I am, I drink quite a bit of coffee in the morning. I drink it black. I drink some cream in it on the weekends. And, you know, you're always seeing these studies that are lurching back and forth on caffeine and coffee, right? And it seems that more of the studies now are saying, yeah, coffee's pretty good for you, the antioxidant aspect of it. And now the latest here, a September study from the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Boy, it's a big thing on the business card, isn't it, right? Anyway, found that coffee or caffeine consumption is a significant protection against cardiometabolic multimorbidity. Now, that's a big mouthful, too. And this refers to having at least two disorders affecting the heart, or metabolism, type 2 diabetes, coronary heart disease, stroke, chronic kidney disease, or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And caffeine has the potential to adversely affect the heart in higher doses. It's welcome news that they're talking moderate amounts, and, you know, 2-3 cups of coffee, you know, that sort of thing. But still, overall, pretty good. Of course, they also found out that smoking, you know, protect you against Parkinson's. I wouldn't suggest you take up smoking to protect yourself from Parkinson's. But hey, a good study is a good study is a good study. We'll take that. All right. All right. Mike O'Neill's going to join me here in a couple of minutes from the Landmark Legal Foundation. And he's been studying what the states are doing to clean up and protect the integrity of the electorate, of the election system. And he'll give us the latest on the this all coming up.
Since 1938, Blue Star Gas has been serving Jackson and
Shows.com.
Hi, I'm Lamont Morley, and I'm on 106.7 KMED.
20 minutes after 6, Mike O'Neill joins me from the Landmark Legal Foundation. And this is part of what the Ronald Reagan Legal Center. Isn't that right here? Welcome back here, Mike. Good to have you on.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about Landmark. What is the basic mission of Landmark Legal? I've spoken with you for a few times, but maybe somebody is hearing you for the first time. You never know.
Sure. We're a national public interest law firm. We were originated in the late 1970s, so we've actually been around for going on almost close to 50 years now, if you can imagine that. Time goes really fast. In a nutshell, we want to promote liberty and we want to combat tyranny. Don't like solidification, and we don't like imposition of the tyrannical power of a federal government. We want to ensure that there's a separation of powers. We want to ensure that administrative agencies are not overstepping their constitutional bounds, that the executive branch is not overstepping its constitutional bounds. We agree. We think that the government should stay in its constitutional lanes, that our founders had a vision for the United States, and they decided that and it was encapsulated in the Constitution, that they said that the executive, the judicial, and the legislative branches all play in their own lanes. And that is the best way to prevent tyranny through separation of powers. So that's what we promote. We want to fight for liberty and we want to fight against tyranny.
I really appreciate what you were talking about, especially trying to rein in the administrative power out there, because that's something, especially here in Oregon, that we see a lot of it. And well, I'll give you an example. The Department of Environmental Quality is always very proudly releasing reams of, hey, here's how many people that we fined this month, or how many businesses that we've ended up fining. Here's an air quality violation over at Timber Products that is one of the most recent ones, you know, several thousand dollars. And of course, this is actually a productive business. And yet, at the same time, little or nothing is said about the weeks or months of wildfire smoke imposed on the area from bad management, administrative management of the federal forest lands surrounding us out here in the West Coast. Yeah. But we're going to go after a business that actually hires people, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Look at all the wonderful things we've done by punishing people for the laws that we've made up and the tyranny that we've imposed upon them. And it's you see it invariably throughout history, not to get off course, but you just see whenever power always wants to be consolidated. Once somebody has power, they invariably want more. So administrative agencies always want to be looking for something to make themselves relevant. So they're always looking to grab more and more power. Well, there are guardrails in our system, and that's what we want to ensure, that those guardrails are enforced. And that's what Landmark likes to do.
All right. Glad to hear this. Hey, Mike, I wanted to find out, though, kind of catch us up here, because I've read a couple of stories about some of the states that are working to clean up voter rolls, you know, Arizona. Yeah. And I'm trying to think of what was the other one. Was it
Oklahoma?
Oklahoma. And which state ended up taking about 500,000 or more bad voters, you know, off of the rolls?
Yeah, that was Oklahoma. And
that was
something that this is something that needs to be done. I mean, it's good that we're talking about it now. And obviously we're talking about it because it's October. Now it's October 1st, an election year. We're like 35 days out from an election. So people are talking about this now, but this is something that really state officials are tasked with doing. State election officials are tasked with ensuring the integrity and accuracy of their voter rolls. And this is something they should be doing all the time. And then that entails removing ineligible voters from the voter rolls. Well, the federal law only applies to what is ineligible under federal law. Under federal law, the NVRA, ineligible means somebody who's died or no longer resides in the jurisdiction in that state. So Oklahoma did some due diligence and looked at some databases and did essentially their job and identified approximately 450,000 names of individuals who are no longer eligible. That means they've either died or moved out of Oklahoma.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting purpose on this, and everybody asks this question. It says, well, what about non-citizens? We're seeing this popping up now because, of course, we had an influx of millions of non-citizens into our country, and invariably, when they get driver's licenses, when they apply for benefits, social benefits, invariably their names will appear on voter rolls. That is a fact. You know, you're going to hear the left say that this is a myth, this doesn't happen, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's a fact. You saw Virginia removed several thousand of names of non-citizens from their voter rolls.
And by the way, Oregon was caught the other week with about a little over 1,200. My suspicion, though, is that it is considerably more than that because there's not a lot of interest in digging into it. And by the way, the state didn't catch it. It was a nonprofit organization that was looking at the voter rolls that caught it.
Right. Exactly. It depends on the state. That states should exercise their due diligence. But what's unfortunate, and this is what you might have heard in the past week or two with the continuing resolution out here in Washington, D.C., the Speaker of the House had attached a new law called the SAVE Act, saying, look, that we're going to expand this obligation to states to identify and remove non-citizens from their voter rolls. Well, that law, unfortunately, didn't get through Congress. But that doesn't mean that states can't do something and that, you know, nonprofit groups, advocacy groups like the one you're referring can actually do some due diligence and determine whether non-citizens are on voter rolls. Again, Virginia did this. But it would really be helpful if there was some sort of, if there was a national push for this, if there was a national, a federal obligation to actually do this. And federal resources were actually shared affirmatively with the states. You have the DHS might have a database, Social Security might have a database, that they can share this information to identify, again, non-citizens on the voter rolls. It's an interesting issue because what's really funny is that if a non-citizen casts a vote, they just committed a felony. And so it's not a good thing even for, you know, you'll have the left and Democrats say, well, you know, it's a crime. But you don't want to have non-citizens on voting rolls because not only obviously they're ineligible to vote. And I think the overwhelming majority of the Americans agree that you have to be a citizen to vote in our federal and state elections, but that you're also exposing these individuals to criminal culpability. And they might unknowingly do this. For example, let's just posit a hypothetical for you.
Yeah.
You're a non-citizen in California, and somehow you've registered for a driver's license. You didn't check the right box. Your name went on the voter rolls. Well, in California, everybody gets a mail-in ballot, no matter what. If your name's on the voter roll, it doesn't matter whether you've indicated whether you want to vote in person or via mail. You're gonna get a ballot.
It's what happens in Oregon too. It's only vote by mail in Oregon. So yeah, everybody gets it.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Same sort of thing. So you get the ballot. And you're not a citizen, and you just get it in the mail, and you say, well, okay, they must know what they're doing. They wouldn't have sent me this ballot if I couldn't cast it. You fill it out, you vote for it, drop it in the mail. Guess what? You just committed a felony, and you didn't even realize you did it. So this is what's crazy to me, is that there should be a push from both sides of the aisle on this, is because you're exposing individuals to criminal culpability that they would not otherwise have been exposed to. And again, I'm not saying that eligible people shouldn't vote. I'm saying that states need to take the due diligence, to exercise due diligence, and do their jobs, and state election officials should do their jobs and ensure eligible individuals are on their voter rolls and clean up their voter rolls. So that's part one. You know, you have the voter rolls as part one, is ensuring the accuracy of those rolls. Part two, of course, is the integrity of the actual election system. This is maintaining ballots are secure. I don't know if you guys have drop boxes in Oregon. I'm assuming you probably do.
Yeah, we do have drop boxes. Yeah. Most of the ones that I'm aware of, though, are generally observed, and they have video cameras on them. And it's not where they just throw them up at the 7-Eleven, let's say. We're better than some states in that respect. Yeah.
Have you all had vote by mail for a long time? I seem to remember in the recesses of my mind that you guys have had universal vote by mail for a long time. So it might have, the system might have been a little more perfected than other states. Is that true, or is that not?
We've had universal voting by mail for a long, long time. And it's kind of interesting because we've never had a Republican governor ever since that happened. I don't know if there's a connection or not. But we have some real problems. And I think that I don't think there is any way to do a vote by mail system securely because there is no matter what happens, there's no chain of custody and you can't guarantee chain of custody. And I don't know, maybe at some point the voters will figure this out. But the controlling party in Oregon is Democrat.
Right.
They're doing fine with the system the way it is, which is why I don't think they see many problems here.
You usher in a one-party rule and one-party system. And again, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, Bill, is one-party rule invariably leads to tyrannical rule. When you have no check on your power base and there's nobody watching the watchers, unfortunately what happens is you have imposition of this tyrannical system on people. So you need a bicameralism. You need a two-party system. You need somebody to check your power. And again, as you're saying, vote by mail is not the ideal system. It was not too long ago. It was universally agreed that by both Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, that the riskier of the two systems, the ideal system was vote in person on election day and have paper ballots and have clear chains of custody, identification. I mean, you have to show identification for everything. And you guys have heard this 100 times, but you have to show identification for virtually everything in this world. You should be obligated to show identification in person to vote in person. And again, I can't believe I'm saying things that are controversial, but here we are in 2024 saying things that are controversial. So going forward, you want to see states that are not only securing their voter rolls, but are also taking steps to ensure that the election is run smoothly when you have widespread in-person voting. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, in Virginia, we want to have paper ballots. You want to have optical scanners. You don't want to have your counting machines attached to the internet. You want to have observers. You want to have access to. Everybody can watch the counting process. There are a lot of states that are now enacting hand counting measures to confirm it. Again, paper ballots are really important versus electronic ballots, so you actually have physical evidence of a vote. So if you have to enter into a recount, if the margins are very thin and narrow, then you actually have a paper ballot. You actually have evidence of a vote that has been cast. Again, if I'm talking about widespread use of mail voting, you really don't want to have ballot harvesting. You want to obligate the individual who actually cast the ballot to turn the ballot into a drop box or to turn it into an election office. This ballot harvesting is rife with influence and rife with undue influence, rife with exposure for risk and fraud. So these are the sorts of common sense measures that you want to see states enacting. Some states are doing it, some states aren't. You know that we have this patchwork system in our country where some states are going to do their due diligence and some states not. We're going to have to see, buckle up for the next 4 weeks. We're going to see how it all plays out.
Michael, in your legal opinion, should elections be federalized? One set of rules for everybody rather than – has federalism failed in this particular case with this patchwork quilt?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think time will play out that you'll see that the states that are doing it right and that have enacted the common sense protections and that people in those states have faith in the outcome of the election. If you federalize it, what's going to happen? Invariably, you're going to have the left control it. Okay, because if you have federal law, you're going to have at some point the left is going to maintain controls of that axis of power. And It's kind of like the thing with a monarchy. If you have a great noble just king, then times are great, right?
Yeah,
what happens
exactly.
If you have a corrupt and terrible king? So the beauty of our federalist system is it's a patchwork, right? If something is failing here, the damage is minimized to that particular locale and that, and if you want to say, California is a big mess, well, California is a mess, but we don't want California's mess exported all across the country. So I think I am in favor of the constitutional system we have where states are the primary drivers here. However, I will give you one posit. I do think that you can have a floor baseline, and that's what the NVRA does, as I was talking about before. There should be a baseline that every state is required to do to ensure the integrity of their election system. And again, right now what we have is they have to remove ineligible names from the voter rolls. That's a federal obligation, and that means, unfortunately, right now, the definition of ineligible is someone who is dead or has moved out of the jurisdiction. I like to expand that, of course, on a federal level to saying non-citizen. So there is an actual federal obligation on state election officials to identify and remove non-citizens from the vote rolls.
Yeah, that would be a good move here. Of all the, and by the way, I have quite a few states that you've sent me some information on, quite a few states that are working on this. So this is, by the way, I'm talking with Mike O'Neill from Landmark Legal Foundation. And you have quite a few. Are most of the cleanest elections in the red states, or is there no ideological bent to the ones that are cleaning up? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I would, objectively speaking, I think so. I would say that. I'd say the system is showing that the individuals who are tasked with ensuring the integrity of it are doing their jobs. You see, Oklahoma saying, hey, look, we've taken affirmative steps to identify and remove 450,000 names of ineligible individuals from our voter rolls. You see in Virginia, okay, we're having paper ballots. We're promoting in-person voting over mail voting. You only receive a mail ballot if you actually come into your registrar's office, sign an affirmation so that they have a signature verification. We don't just automatically mail everybody their ballots. So I think the faith in those election systems is what's important. And what happens is if we lose faith in the integrity of the system, then it's gone forever. And unfortunately, that's what we've been seeing a lot over the past 4 or 5 years. We've been seeing a lot of loss in faith in our systems, you know, in our electoral systems, in our financial systems, in our, police and firefighters. If you see loss in these systems that form the bulwark of our society, it becomes dangerous for society to continue to function. So generally speaking, I mean, if I have to take it from a 30,000-foot view, you want to see election officials doing their jobs. You want reassurances that they are doing their jobs. And in a lot of these states, again, I'm saying Virginia, Oklahoma, et cetera, you're seeing that being done.
Mike, I really appreciate the take on it. Thanks for the update. I'm going to share the information, and we will certainly have you back. And boy, the next month or so, it's going to be a wild ride. You can already feel it, can't you? Can't you already feel it coming?
It's going to be a wild ride. We're going to buckle up, as I said before. We'll see how this all plays out in the next 35, 40 days here.
I have to ask you, though, what happens in a state like North Carolina, a battleground state right now, and a lot of damage? What do the laws say about stuff like that? I know that voting is probably, last on their minds right now when there's no power, food, water, that kind of thing.
Right.
But ultimately, what happens?
I mean, ultimately, you want to have emergency systems in place I think we have 30 days now, so it's going to be in a few weeks that the systems can get up. But you want to have redundancies built into the system so that on election day, and I'm not sure, I think most people probably, I said we're talking 2024, most people are probably going to vote in person on election day. I could be wrong, but I think North Carolina is going to expect about 80% of the people to vote in person. You want to have redundancies and emergencies. This is why it's, again, important to prepare for this and to build in redundancies into the system. So when unforeseen events like a hurricane or flooding occur, that you can have some sort of system in place where people, alternative system where that they can vote. So hopefully the election officials are on the ground doing the work, doing what's necessary to ensure that the system functions at least as close as normal as possible in North Carolina. And we're praying for those folks because it is truly a horrific event.
Oh, gotcha. More than 120 or so dead at last count. Mike O'Neill, landmarklegal.org. Thank you for the update. We'll stay in touch, all right? Be well.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thank you. It's 636 at KMED, 99.3 KBXG. You're waking up with the Bill Myers Show. Number here is 770-5633.
It's gutter season.
The 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com, promo code Clay.
You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
20 before 7, Pebble in Your Shoe Tuesday, 770-5633. And whatever happens to be on your mind, delighted to talk with you. Let's talk with Vicki first. How you doing, Vicki? Welcome. What's on your mind?
Good. I know that I've called in before about having to go in and actually vote on paper ballots, and I know that's not going to happen in Oregon anytime soon.
No, probably not. That is a realistic way of looking at things. Yes.
My thought is that if you're going to have a box, which they have one on West Main, I know they have one by the crowd, is to have some people set up tables and actually have to get out of your car, go up to the table, show your ID, verify your signature, and have them put your ballot in the box. That way, if something is not right, then the responsibility goes from you to them. They're responsible for your vote.
Okay. I don't understand. All right, so as it is right now, you drive up and you drop the vote in, right?
Right.
You drop the ballot into there, into that, and that's on you. What would adding the other person do, Vicki?
Well, I think just the fact that so many people are worried about fraud and everything with the voting.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't allow us to go in and actually vote at a voting station, then at least you should be required to get out of your vehicle, go up, verify with your photo and your signature, and then you could drop it in the box. It doesn't matter who drops it in the box, as long as it's verified. When you just drive up and put it in the box, there's no way of verifying that that's really you.
But you see, that's the entire aspect. That's the entire weakness of the vote-by-mail system. And anything, I think, that would attack that ease of use, which is we don't really check too hard, that would have to come from the legislature. I don't think there's any way you do that, you know, with any...
It's unfortunate that they can't put something on a ballot, upcoming ballot, that requires them to actually verify who you are, and then you just drop your ballot into the box.
Do you think that the most or the majority of Oregon voters like the current system as it is, or do you think that there's dissatisfaction with it? Because I don't know if most people have a dissatisfaction with it at this point. And I think it's only Republicans or people who are not part of the Democratic blob, so to speak, that are having a problem with it. So do you think that they would join us on something like that, actually wanting to make it more difficult to vote, having to verify?
That's the whole thing, Bill. This whole world is so wrapped in convenience everywhere. They want it to be so convenient that they don't actually have to exert any extra energy or purpose to do things. I see it all the time. It's on the internet. Oh, just, order it from the internet. Don't actually go to a store, get out and buy it. I know a lot of people do still. But
yeah, I know. And that ends up being a self-perpetuating situation. The more people that buy it online, then the less it gets stocked in local stores. And then the local stores go away. And then... it's kind of a trap. Yeah, I know.
Well, and I think them taking the actual paper voting away has benefited the people that want convenience. It's all about convenience. How hard is it to drive up to a box, stick it in, you're off on your way?
Well, I know, Vicki, that our founding fathers were saying, give us convenience or give us death. I seem to recall that from the Revolutionary War time. All right.
Yeah, well, at this time, and not maybe death, but a severe...
Well, I'm having fun with give us liberty or give me liberty or give me death, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
All right.
I just think today revolves around too much with convenience and not enough actual... And maybe it's because I live in the country and we do everything ourselves pretty much.
Yeah, could be.
I don't live in town, so I have to work pretty much for anything and everything, and so... The convenience of it is outweighing the importance of it, I guess, is my point.
Yeah, all right. And I appreciate you making that point. Thank you very much there, Vicki. Let me go from the Applegate to Chris in Medford. Hello, Chris. How are you? Welcome.
Morning. So I do have a pebble in my shoe about this dock worker strike.
Okay.
By the way,
to catch people up here, Chris, the dock workers are supposedly being offered right now a 50% increase in pay over the next 4 or 5 years and a promise to not automate the jobs quite so much, but they're still turning that down, apparently. So that's where we are right now, okay?
Right. And so, first off, I think that's a very reasonable offer. I think that some automation it has to happen. Welcome to our century.
Yeah.
There is just so much automation now, and businesses are there to make money. I understand people that have worked very hard and invested themselves, and I think a $5 an hour pay raise each year, I would take it right now.
Is that what that pay raise works out to? $5 an hour each year? every year goes up for the next stuff?
Every year for 8 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I know there are a lot of people just be happy to get the $25 an hour over the 5 years. But
Right. But they're not promising no automation, which is what put it in the ringer.
Yeah, that is probably not a realistic stance. But you got to understand those dock jobs, the crane operators, all the rest of it, those are very, very high paying jobs, you know, at this point in time. And
I do understand that I work in an industry that is dependent on these shipments. Mm-hmm. And so people like me who aren't on average earning $39 an hour, we're the ones impacted by this.
Yep.
We're the ones that are going to lose business by this. They're going to come back and they're going to get their contract, and whether they take the $5 an hour over 8 years or they get the 80% raise that they want.
They want an 80% raise? Is that what they're asking for?
They wanted an 80% raise and no automation. That was their...
Okay. Yeah. You know, that seems to me to be a guarantee that those dock workers' jobs are going to be automated as quickly as possible. I'm kind of thinking about the Los Angeles area fast food workers. Same sort of thing. Yep, we want $30. We want $30 an hour. That does it. I'm buying a hamburger machine. You know, that's what happens.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly what's going to happen. And in the meantime, it's going to throw our economy into chaos. So they're not. I understand you got to be out for yourself, but at the same time, when you look at the broader picture, they're not going to be able to buy their auto parts. They're not going to be able to find certain produce. They're going to run into the same issues as the rest of the United States while they're not working because they're on strike because they want 80% and no automation.
Yeah. Yeah. Not realistic. Chris, I appreciate the update of your opinion on that. Okay. Really do. It's 6:48. All right. You ever get the feeling that the world sometimes is run by clowns and stooges? Well, we're going to actually detour into the world of the Three Stooges for just a little bit. Kind of a little comedic sidebar. And I'm going to be talking with a gentleman who actually wrote, and frankly, it's a more interesting book than I thought it would be. Bert Kearns, author and journalist. And he wrote the book, Shemp, I kid you not, about Shemp, the Three Stooges guy. And I'm finding it very enjoyable. I'll tell you all about that. Coming up here in the next few.
Drake's Paint and Supply.
30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Promo code Clay.
This is News Talk 106.3 KMED. And you're waking up with the Bill Myers Show.
I don't know if Bert Kearns is going to make it in for his interview time or not. But, Hey, Matt, can you call me after 7 o'clock? I think Bert's calling, okay? Can you do that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll call you later.
Okay, give me a few minutes.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, right, we got to do this because my line's picking up here, and I'm going to see if I can get Bert Kearns on. Is this Michael on Premier? Who's this? Good morning. Hello?
Hey, this is Bert Kearns.
Oh, it is Bert. Hey, Bert, Bill Meyer at KMED. I was waiting for your call. I'm glad you finally made it in here. Thank you very much. I was on the phone with other people and just had to grab you and pick you up. Bert Kearns, by the way, author. I need a more appropriate musical introduction for Bert, because Bert's an author, journalist, film, and TV producer. Dubbed by Vanity Fair is a show business and pop culture savant. Does that mean you're like Rain Man, kind of like you're a very good writer? You're very good writer, Bert. Welcome to the show. Good to have you on this morning.
I think they left out the word idiot with savant, but there you go.
Bert has written a book called Shemp. It's the biography of the Three Stooges, Shemp Howard. And you know, when this came to me, I'm thinking to myself, really? Okay, you're going after a Shemp of all the Three Stooges. This is the one you never hear anything about. And I'm kind of wondering if this is why. I mean, I watched these shorts all the time when I was a kid. I got in trouble with my mom when I tried to do to my brother and sister what the Three Stooges did to one another. I imagine you did too, Bert. Welcome. And what's on your mind with why Shemp? Why'd you go after Shemp here? Huh?
That actually was the same story I had as far as watching when I was a kid and doing things to my brother and my mother complaining. But, you know, I took on this project originally because when we started this project, there hadn't been a book about Shemp. There's been books about Mo Howard,
yep.
Curly, Larry, even Joe Besser and Joe DiRita, who followed Shemp later. But there had never been a book about Shemp. So it seemed very interesting to begin with. And then what began as a simple, you know, biography project turned into this archaeological dig, because I found that much of what has been written about Shem and about the Three Stooges history just isn't true, because all of it is based on this Bible called I Stooged to Conquer, and that was the autobiography that Mo wrote shortly before his death. His daughter had to finish it for him.
Yeah.
All the Stooges information, a lot of it comes from this book, which really is a work of fiction. And I found that out by going back to the sources, going to the original trade papers and newspaper accounts of what was going on in the Three Stooges history. So I sort of don't want to pat myself on the back with it, but sort of rewrote Three Stooges history with this book.
You know, Bert, the thing is, it seems apparent that Mo really had an issue with his brother. He must have loved him, but still, he just threw him under the bus, it sounds like, in that original history, right?
Well, I mean, from the beginning in this book, he portrays Shemp as this phobic, scaredy-cat bedwetter. I mean, who would write a book about their older brother who had passed away 20 years earlier and, you know, say that he was a bedwetter? That he, you know, Shemp was inducted into the U.S. Army during World War I. He was discharged because he was brought in the replacement draft right before the war ended. The armistice was signed, and then they sent everybody home. Mo writes that he was kicked out of the Army for bedwetting. And then I found, you know, the discharge information, discharge papers. There's no backing for that. That wasn't true. This was sort of a dig to make Shemp seem a bit more like the character you saw on screen.
Yeah, must have been.
There's a three Stooges.
You know,
like Mo, Larry, and Curly, very easy to caricature and parody. Mo was the angry one. Larry was the sort of befuddled everyman.
Yeah.
And Curly was this wild dervish. So Shemp in the Stooges was this frightened, timid character going, "Oh, Mo, look out, there's a bat over there, there's a ghost," or whatever.
Yeah.
And I found that, you know, Shemp wasn't like that in his earlier career when he went solo for 13 years, was in more than 100 shorts and motion pictures alongside people like James Stewart, John Wayne, Marlena Dietrich, Abbott and Costello, and W.C. Fields. When he was out there on his own, he never played that scared character. He played a lot of different kinds of characters, a very varied and versatile entertainer.
And what I also found interesting about this, Bert Kearns, by the way, author of Shemp, the biography of the Three Stooges, Shemp Howard. And I found it a fascinating look back at the early times of film and also getting into television a little bit later on. But, you know, the way you describe it, because, you know, these were the Howard brothers or the Horvitz, right? That was their actual name, Bert, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Their last name, Horvitz.
That's true, yes.
And they were all Russians. All the Stooges were Russians, Lithuanian descent, and various. It's really interesting background going into it. And but I even had to laugh because you go in there. Where did they come up with the name Shemp? Because his real name was what? Shmuel? How do you pronounce
Shmuel.
That? Shmuel. Okay.
Yeah, Shmuel.
Shmuel.
Really, Shmuel, which Shmuel. Is translated to Samuel. Yeah.
Right. And so.
And his mother couldn't pronounce it. She called him Shemp.
Yeah, as an immigrant, right? She just couldn't do the English, right? So it would end up being Shemp.
That's correct, yeah.
I got to love that. What do you think we're going to end up taking away from this? Because I think that the Three Stooges, and by the way, I think I lost all my female listeners right now because I don't know what it is, Bert, but have you noticed that it's only guys that seem to get the Three Stooges? Is it just me or is this true?
Well, that's always been the thing. You know, some people compare the Three Stooges to pro wrestling. You know, there's some violence and there's some comedy. And I think that's part of it. But I'll tell you, if there ever is an entrance for females into the Three Stooges genre, Shemp is the one, because Shemp was the sexy one. You know, even though he was voted the ugliest man in Hollywood at one point.
And he seemed to actually like that. He actually liked that, right? He seemed to actually take pride in that, being the ugliest guy in Hollywood, right?
Proud, yeah. He was proud. But yeah, I think Shemp is the one. Shemp is the sexy one. He was the one who could dance. He was the ladies' man in a lot of the shorts as well.
Yeah, and I think that's also why Mo seemed to throw him under the bus a bit there, because even back in school, I think it was Shemp was the ladies' man, what you're writing about. I thought it was fascinating to read this. But what are you hoping that we will take from this? I mean, a lot of people think, I got three Stooges, and who cares? I get it, but why do you think other people should get it?
Well, along with setting the record straight on showbiz history, I mean, I recently watched, just this week, the movie The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, where they have the line, you know, when legend becomes fact, print the legend. Well, I kind of cut through the legend and got down to the facts in this. But I hope people will look at some of Shemp's solo work. It's all, you can find it online, you can find it on YouTube, and it's on Blu-ray. But there's some great things out there, from W.C. Fields in The Bank Dick to Shemp was in Five Abbott and Costello Pictures. He was in one of the Thin Man movies. He does a great role in a movie called Murder Over New York, which was a Charlie Chan picture. And if you find a movie, you go in the listings, go on IMDb and find something that Shemp is in. He might be in it for a scene or two. He might be in it, you know, through the whole picture, but you're going to see something you didn't expect. He was so versatile. He was always able to add something to a picture.
And I never knew about that. And now it's going to make me look up some of this. But I also enjoyed the early history of film and how there wasn't Hollywood at that point. And I guess when they first started doing their things, it was New Jersey, right? It was Thomas Edison and the Black Mariah stage. And I guess Vitagraph was the other big competitor at that point. It was an East Coast deal back in those days when they first got started.
It was all East Coast. It started in New Jersey. And then just, you know, fortuitously, the Vitagraph studios you mentioned were in Brooklyn, where the Stooges lived and were born. And as kids, you know, Mo says that as a kid, he would take the train to the Vitagraph studios, hang out and do errands for actors, and managed to get himself into about 20 motion pictures as a child actor. Now, that's a great story Mo told, until you find out that there's no evidence of this at all. You know, quite, you know, conveniently, all those early pictures were destroyed in a fire.
Uh-huh.
So Mo is the only source for the story that he was a child actor in 20 pictures. Yet, when Shemp quit the Stooges when he was a bit older in the early 1930s, he went to Vitagraph, which by that point had been bought by Warner Brothers, called Vitaphone, and Shemp starred in dozens of shorts and films over there. And Shemp became a star at Vitaphone.
You'll really enjoy this book. It's Bert Kearns, author of Shemp. Shemp is the book, the biography of the Three Stooges, Shemp Howard. And Bert, I know you got to talk with other people, but I appreciate you sharing a few minutes from L.A., okay? You take care. Be well. Good
hey,
job on this.
Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah. And like I said, this is a really different kind of book. And I have to tell you, I was not expecting to like it, but I just went and got a copy of it because it was different. It was something outside of my normal comfort zone, you know, politics and various other things. And the early history of comedy, and also how badly injured the Stooges got when they were doing all of these shorts. It's just the sort of stuff that that Bert goes into it. And I honestly think that a lot of times Shemp died because of the abuse of Mo. Because Mo was the one that handed out most of the physical abuse, and he also threw most of his brothers under the bus. Oh, well, it's family, right?